I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 1962. The album, The First Family, the artists, Bob Booker, Earl Dowd, Vaughn Meader, Naomi Brossard, a bunch of other people. My guest this week is Rich Vulture. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, I'm here.
You are. I really appreciate you doing the show, especially after all the crazy headache that I've probably caused you in setting it up. But I want to know why. I mean, you were born several years after this album came out, as I was. So I want to know when you heard it first and why it is something of interest to you.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know about you, but I used to go through my parents' records just because I was curious. And this was, you know, years later. And it was like they all had similar records. I noticed with some of my friends was the Bob Newhart album.
Sure.
Herb Albert.
Yes,
and
of course.
The Lonely Ball. And this, The First Family, was one of them. And I was just I was just playing it out of curiosity, and I was fascinated by it when I first heard it. But when I played it, I don't know about you, whenever I was sick or home from school, I would listen to records or cassettes, and I just listened to this one over and over and over again. I don't know why. I listen to other records, but there's something about this one that just, it was almost like you were learning something about the family as well. You know, about history.
Sure. Did you have any perspective, though, on who JFK was beyond school? Like, it's just a weird... It's just such a very seminal this period of history record that like literally went away. Like literally the sequel album was pulled off the shelves after he was assassinated. So like this is not a thing. Did your parents tell you about it, or did you just grab it and figured it out for yourself?
I just grabbed it and picked it up. I mean, at first I didn't know about the Kennedys that much at all.
Okay.
But there's something about this album's laugh track that really gets me. I don't know why. It's like they're playing it in an auditorium or something. I don't know where they recorded it. Do you know?
You know, I have asked, oh my goodness. I asked one lady. What's hilarious is I did ask one lady who was in it and does not remember being in it, if she remembers anything about it. And she actually did seem to remember being there for the recording. Oh, where did she tell me? I'm trying to see if I have the note here at all. I don't remember exactly. It's somewhere in New York, but I don't remember the name of the club or the
But it was
theater.
Like the sound reverberated and stuff.
Yeah.
And I love it when you can hear people, like you can hear the same people laughing throughout the album.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's this one guy that would always go, sort of like... if you listen to like old Rhodas or Taxis, there's always a guy that goes, like you can distinctly hear that guy. So, I mean, these sort of stick with me. And I mean, I just listen for that many times. And then sometimes I know they must have played with the, like the laughter in the end, because, you know, it wouldn't get that big of a laugh, but then they would crank it and do the huge laugh.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of blackouts in this,
yeah, yeah.
This album, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very old school and everything. And so I'm sure they had to rely a lot on, a good audience, and I don't even know if they taped it more than once or...
Yeah, that is something I don't know, because literally, if you look on the Wikipedia, it just says it was recorded in front of a live audience. If I had the... This is so stupid, by the way. If I had the record in front of me, it's a dumb thing to say. It's in my closet that I can't get to, and I have 20 copies of it, because I have a weird obsession with it, so...
You have 20 copies?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Oh
it's
my
a, it's
God.
It's a disorder. My wife hates it. My wife
How,
absolutely
first
hates
of all, how much are they worth?
Nothing. That's why they're so, it was so, for those who aren't aware, maybe you don't know, but like it hit it when it made a record, pardon me, like a world record for a number of records sold. It was at the end of 62 when it came out, and it sold 7.5 million copies. No comedy, no record, comedy or otherwise, had ever sold that much. So it was, and honestly, I was talking to somebody the other day. I'm like, how many other records do you think have sold that much in terms of vinyl? And they're like, probably none. Like, it's a ton of vinyl to be flipping around out there, other than maybe the Beatles, of course. But like, this is such a giant chunk of an album, and it's, at least here in Burbank, it's never not been on in stock in any record store I've been to. Every estate sale has had one, so I tend to buy them.
Damn it. Because I was thinking it must be in my parents' house, and mm-hmm. they must have it somewhere.
I'm sure. Yeah, they're not. I mean, I've always wanted a sealed copy, but that's just for me. That's just a particular thing that I want to have. But
that
would
be
worth shit.
Something.
It would be fun to have
a sealed copy.
Did you go to the extent, did you memorize it? Did you have, or did you not, maybe not actively, did you have any of the bits memorized?
Well, here's another thing that I liked about the, you know, the album was there are so many quotable bits.
Yeah.
It's like when you know, there's a movie like Caddyshack or like Raising Arizona.
Sure.
There were just so many things I just kept repeating over and over, like I don't know, for some reason I like the term I am standing in my shorts dripping wet, and I would just say that over and over again. It was also a chance to practice a Boston accent,
of course. Sure.
The bathroom is a where is the bathroom, the rubber swan is mine. There's just like so many things that you that scene where they're ordering the delicatessen sandwiches. There's so many good ones there. I listened to it recently, and some of that sounds a little bit racist now.
Sure. Yeah. There are, I always forget that those bits are in here, because I always, and anytime anybody has picked it, which has only been a few times, I'm like, oh, great, I love that record. And then I turn it on, like, oh, right, I have actively blanked some of this out. Like, I have forgotten some of this actively.
I know. Be careful what you publicly say you like. But I mean, honestly, that's. But I mean, it's like a slice of history.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. Yeah.
Yeah. And just the voices were so distinct and clear. And, Jackie Kennedy was so good.
She's very good. She's very good. I have been trying to get her. She is like the only star of the record still around.
And, really?
Yeah, and I've been trying to speak to her either on the podcast or get an interview with her by email. She's older, so harder to sort of nail down as an interview. But yeah, she's the only one left in terms of like the main character. But she's phenomenal. I love her.
Maybe she doesn't know what a podcast is.
Oh, most people don't. When I reach them, they're like, "This is radio. This is," and I get it. Totally get it. Like, it is a confusing thing to explain to somebody. So.
People are trackable.
Yes, for sure.
I'm sure you could get this person. That would be so good.
I will say I have spoken to her. I just, nailing her down for an interview is the hard part. I did, and people, this is going to be people who listen to the show regularly, those five of them, they're going to know that this has already happened. But I did interview Vaughn Meter's widow for an episode too, and that was a hell of a lot of fun.
Oh, my goodness.
Fascinating. Also, I no longer like Von Meter as a person at the end.
Oh, you don't? She's not a fan?
She is. She loves him. But there are a couple things she said where I'm like, did you hear what you just said about the man you fell in love with? But, you know, people are complicated.
Because I remember like reading like about Dick Van Dyke.
Mm-hmm.
When he first came to L.A., his, you know, one of his big fans was Stan, or he was a big fan of Stan Laurel.
Yeah.
So he just decided out of the blue, I'm going to look up his address and I'm going to knock on his door. And sure enough, he answered the door and then he says, you know, can I go out? You know, can we have a coffee? And that's how it all started. So I'm just thinking maybe the same thing.
Right.
With you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you know, I just show up at that poor lady's front door.
Stalk. I guess it's called stalking.
Yeah. I'd forgotten that about Stan Laurel and Dick Van Dyke. That is like, that is the best possible reaction. I mean, I have also interviewed people, you know, I interviewed a guy, Jay Sandrich, who directed probably some of those episodes of Rhoda that you heard. Although I've heard that James Burrows has a distinctive laugh, so maybe that's who you were hearing. But I think that might be him. I'm going to have to ask him or James L. Brooks. It might be James L. Brooks.
I've got to find out who that voice was.
I've heard somebody talk about that exact laugh before, so I'm going to have to dig around. But I interviewed a guy named Jay Sandrich, who is like James Burrows' like mentor and stuff. And his story is what you just told me, but the version of how you get into the industry. Like, he literally walked onto Desilu Studios, no security, and said, hey, you got any jobs going? It's like, sure. You want to be a PA on Lucy? And so he was a PA on I Love Lucy, and that's how his career started. Just walking onto the
Jay Sandrich?
Lot. Yeah.
Yeah, you hear so many of those. Mm-hmm. I think it was a lot easier to do that back then.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, I can't, especially since I moved out here right after 9/11, where security was the utmost, you know, everywhere. It was, there was no way you were getting in without multiple.
There's no way.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Do you have a favorite bit off of this album? Is there one particular thing that stands out? Again, I love that you kind of had bits and pieces that were just random quotes that appealed to you. I like that that's kind of where you went with this.
I'm big on quotes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably the best thing I like the big group scenes. I like the, yep. You know, the press conference and things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I believe I answered that question last night, but in case you haven't, here is my response. Itty bitty waddy woo, witty witty waddy woo. You know, that just, I love stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And there's two press conferences in the mm-hmm. album. One is with his family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a good, what I like about it too is it's got heart to it, mm-hmm. like that little bedtime story at the end. And also the when he and Jackie are alone at the and looking for a party.
Mm-hmm.
The Rusks are having a party, Jackie. That's always a quote.
Mm-hmm.
And laugh it up, Jackie. I guess the economy lunch, of course. I love mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. I love that. Mr. Khrushchev, would you please stop banging our shoe on the table?
Is this the kind of thing, like, I honestly, when you came back to me with this as your choice, I was surprised only because, and maybe I shouldn't be by now, because other people surprise me like this too, but based on your own, for lack of a better word, brand of comedy, based on the type of comedy you do, this is not what I expected at all. I expected something a little more counterculture. Maybe that's me just being an idiot.
Oh, you know, I do love lots of stuff like that.
Sure.
But
I love that this is one of those, that this is in there. Maybe it's not an influence, but it's still part of like what you listened to growing up and is going to be part of you.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of stuff you listen to, you go in and out of favor over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to think of something that had an influence on me early on. And, you know, there was this Steve Martin's and the Cheech and Chong's and all of that.
Sure.
And but I just immediately just thought of this, in terms of listening to it initially over and over and over again.
It sounds like it was like this kind of comedy comfort food, which is something that doesn't come often come up enough in terms of records. Like it's like there are shows that I will rewatch over and over again because I have a mental problem, but it's comfort food.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, I don't think I was sick a lot at school, but I remember the times I were, I would just, I wouldn't be reading or anything. I'd just be listening. I think I have an oral, is it oral fixation more than visual, I
Sure.
think. And I just sort of, just was drawn to it. And like you said, I mean, I like all sorts of comedy. I love more crazy stuff, but I don't know.
I
This was
mean, but
just
don't we
one.
all sort of also have influences that are more, I don't know, easy to take in, and they also kind of feel adult at the same time, where you're like, oh, this is something that was made for grown-ups, but I'm getting some of it, and I don't know, I feel like that was definitely me as a kid discovering Carlin when I was young, and it was like, oh, look at me, I'm a grown-up, I'm listening to a man swear. So I don't know, this feels like something is like, oh, this is my parents had this, you know? So I feel
Yeah. I remember Carlin being so influential, and everybody was talking about it. I guess part of what it is too is I felt like this was kind of my own little thing amongst my friends and stuff. Like a lot of them didn't even know about it. But we would talk about Carlin and, you know, Cheech and Chong and all of that and listen to it. But this was sort of like my own little
I love that. I love
weird.
it. Yeah, having your own little influence or the thing that you are like particularly, I don't know. I don't. If you'd have shared this with any of your friends, they might have been like, "That's very old. Why would I bother listening to this?" Because even by the time you're a kid, it's already so old that it's just like, you know, what probably wouldn't have appealed to any of the rest of them, I would
I
assume.
guess maybe some of it too is like a lot of the albums, the comedy albums you listen to are like in clubs. And I always liked the idea of this not being in a club. It was in some sort of, it seems like a high school auditorium.
Right. It does
So
have that
it's like
quality.
a different sort of feel to it. I mean, it's like when you Wild and Crazy Guy, like I always liked the, was it the first side of the album? That was in the nightclub. I
Yeah.
always liked the small nightclub one than the big stadium one.
Right.
I'm a wild and crazy. And then, you
Same.
know, I liked it when he could interact with the audience and stuff. So it seemed like intimate. And
Yeah.
I know this wasn't the first album to do something like that. I mean, I know Nichols and May and, you know. But it just for me it was a different sort of thing, and you know it I got very interested in sketch comedy early on in my years, not as much as Stan. I don't know why I was sort of drawn to sketch comedy and stuff.
Did you know about improv as a kid at all? Did you have any
No, I
concept what that
didn't
could be?
really.
Yeah.
No, I didn't until like later on. And like an ex-girlfriend of mine mentioned it, like, hey, all these people went to Second City. And I go, oh, really? And then I started reading up on it. It was like, oh my God, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
So I was in law school and I just sort of thought, I'm going to graduate from law school, but the minute I do, I'm going to enroll in Second City and then just go straight there.
Wow. Just so that you had a backup, which is
Well,
the thing
that
they
was my
always tell you
bad.
not to do, but.
Well, I mean, I decided I wasn't going to practice law, but I had the knowledge that I was enrolled at Second City to start, you know, whatever that was.
How long did you do Second City? I only ask because Wikipedia is telling me you were at IO Chicago, and I don't know if that's even accurate. So I would love to know, like, what your progression was.
Well, I went to this, it was sort of a crash summer course that normally took about a year. Mm-hmm. And I signed up for it for the summer. And then I did Improv Olympic at the same time. And then I started doing the Annoyance Theater. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't till a couple years later that I did Second City. It almost seemed like all of us together sort of moved at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the first people I heard that went over from Improv Olympic were like Adam McKay. Mm-hmm. And then there was like Steve Carell was already there. I don't think he did Improv Olympic, but then Stephen Colbert. Mm-hmm. And Amy Sedaris. And it just became when Adam McKay went over from it was almost like there were different camps. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and like going to Second City in a way was kind of like selling out.
Okay.
But then all of a sudden McKay went and it was like, okay, it's cool. And you get paid. Why were we even thinking this the whole time? Why did we have this in our head? Mm-hmm. And so everybody, you know, joined. And so there is this sort of period in Second City that had a really heavy improv fueled background. Mm-hmm. And I think it really helped the whole. Yeah.
Do you have a preference in terms of performance or creating comedy? Do you prefer straight up writing sketch or improvising and turning it into something polished or just straight improvising?
I was really, I like improvising cause it's like you do it and then that's it. Mm-hmm. But I've come to appreciate the polishing aspects of it. You know, yeah. That, you know, it's fine to do improv in a scene or something, and sometimes it's better, but most of the time you can improve it so that you can make it even funnier.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is like picking the first family is a really good example of something that I don't even know has ever happened much since the 60s or even before, which is it's almost like the formation of a sketch comedy boy band because they put them together. They weren't a group at all. These guys wrote the sketches. They brought in people they knew that could do the voices. They toured the country with it. And then once that was over, they did a second record. But once the second record was over and the assassination happened, obviously all the touring stops. But it's this weird, like, they're kind of a comedy company, but they're totally just manufactured, totally put together, which I don't know if that's even happened again.
Oh, you mean like it hasn't happened again?
In terms of like straight sketch, like since there's no improv involved, like I know that like Second City obviously tours and continues to tour. That's their thing. And they tour and they use sketches sometimes going back to the beginning of the company. But like just as a purely a sketch group that only does this one type of sketch, which is obviously the same sketches from this record and the second record. I don't think that's ever happened before. And they're a totally manufactured comedy group. It's a weird moment in comedy.
What about like the Firesign Theater and...
But I mean, they came together on their own as a group and wrote their own stuff. So for sure, definitely. I love Firesign, friends of the show, we should point out. But yeah, and for sure, like those like sketch comedy groups that came together as their own thing. But like anybody who wrote, it'd be like me writing a sketch and hiring you and a bunch of other people that I could trust to be funny and making you into a sketch group with no experience as a group together. So it's just a weird moment. But yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many touring sketch groups that I absolutely adore. Firesign and Python, obviously.
Now I'm going to be thinking about it. That as an exception.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there must be. It has to have existed, but it's not something I can think of immediately, because you got me thinking on the touring aspect and the manufacturing aspect, and you know, Second City's got this.
Well, it's definitely not the successful route to take, because you know, I mean, just look at the casts of Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the ones where they have sort of a chemistry and a connection to each other are the better casts.
Sure.
Because they are all assembled randomly.
Mm-hmm.
So one could argue, like, the first cast was the most cohesive a unit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because they had all worked in Lemmings together and other things, and they hung out, Second City and all that. So they really had, but I don't know.
It's a very good point. I mean, they did have that prior experience, and I don't know that anybody other than like one or two people bringing somebody else in, like Lovitz bringing Hartman into SNL. There aren't, you know, every once in a while somebody would piggyback on somebody else's being there or get an advantage from somebody bringing them in. But you're right. Yeah, that first cast, all with the National Lampoon background, especially, and Second City, et cetera, et cetera. I would love to know then, okay, so for your, how briefly were you at IO then?
Oh, I was there for years. I was in it in Los Angeles. So,
okay.
And I was in the Annoyance Theater for a while as well. Mm-hmm. And, so I was in Second City in the touring company, and then I did this show in Edinburgh that we did an Annoyance show called Modern Problems in Science.
Mm-hmm.
It was me and two other guys, and it was an improvised university lecture.
It's such a good idea.
And what we would do is we'd get an absurd scientific hypothesis, and it was usually something crazy like, the center of the universe is a giant baboon named Andre. Something like that absurd, you know, because we said, make it as crazy as possible. Yeah. And then there were three of us. So we would say, I am a professor of what? And then, you know, you'd get gynecology. And then you say, besides gynecology. And then then you'd have to teach as that discipline. So if you were an Egyptologist, you'd have to teach like that. And it really, it was so much fun, mm-hmm. and it caught on, and it also was able to catch on over in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started touring internationally that show.
Mm-hmm. So is Edinburgh then the thing that broke you in the UK?
Yeah. I mean, we did three of them. Okay. We did three consecutive years, and then the group split up. Phil Granchi and Dick Costolo. Dick was actually one of the CEOs of Twitter.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's weird.
And so when we split up, or went our separate ways, it was an amicable split up. It wasn't like I was still in England, and I just sort of thought, well, is there any other work that I asked my manager, can I just, you know, will you represent me as a person, mm-hmm. as an individual? And then, so then that stuff started to happen from that.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. I just read about that recently and am now very sad that I didn't get to see that show live. It's such a very specific, having those built-in limits to an improv show is, I think, maybe scarier than doing just a loose, just a location and a person and a situation. I feel like you have intentionally walled yourself in with limits that I would imagine make you more creative. I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to take that leap too, because in a way people go, oh, didn't you wish you got subjects that you knew a lot about? And to be honest, the subjects that you knew a lot about, you would kind of start to crowbar stuff in, and it wasn't very organic. Whereas if it was something you didn't know that much about, you could just sort of come up with your own bullshit, and it made for like connecting with the other performers, and it was really cool. I mean, sometimes it didn't work, but most of the time it did, and or came close. And it was like a journey that you all sort of piped in together. And it was really a great show. It was one of the better shows that I've been a part of.
That's remarkable. So why did you... What about who you are and the life you were living while you're in law school made you realize comedy was a thing, though? Like, what was there something in the back of your mind the whole time?
Well, I to be honest, I had never really performed or anything, and even though I had thought I wanted to do it, I thought I always knew I wanted to go to law school. Like, it was something I had to actually go through in order to get it out of my system.
Wow. Okay.
Like, the first day I got to law school, I didn't like it at all. I mean, I didn't like, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I decided, well, I'll get the degree. And so in actuality, I had a lot of fun in law school because I wasn't like trying to get, you know, supreme grades or anything. I was just sort of, you know, and I started to do some performing there because I sort of did the talent show they had there every year.
Okay.
Stuff. So that's sort of how I sort of got my foot in the door.
Wow. Wow. This is not a story I've ever heard of anybody who's ever gotten into comedy, even sideways. This is such a... This blows my mind. And it's always like, oh, I knew from the beginning and I quit school, or I did this and I definitely had a plan to be blank thing. But you're just like, no, I'm just going to stick with it. So I've got a degree. And also I'm going to be doing law school talent shows.
There was also a thing where I thought I'll be a lawyer and I'll cover myself. And I'll be an entertainment lawyer. So sure. I got this great job at NPR during the summer, right? It was a great job, but I realized no matter how you slice it, it's still a legal job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're dressing it in entertainment, but it's why not just go and do what you really want to do?
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, I was kind of rationalizing a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my friends, they go, why don't you just do like go work for a firm and work for 2 years and then pay off your loans? And it was like, I knew if I started on that path, I would never, it makes it even harder to break free after that. Because it's like, oh, well, you might make partner in 3 more years. Why would you leave now?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I was firm in this that I was just going to go straight into, you know,
wow,
whatever the second city was.
The sliding doors version of your life, that story sucks. Like, just Rich Vulture becomes partners at a law firm and then we're denied so much comedy. That's not that. I don't like that version of the story. I don't know
if that would have happened regardless, but
good.
Yeah.
Good. Is it safe to assume that you were at IO then while Del Close was there?
Yeah, I took from him. I took classes from him. A couple of classes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know what you've heard.
Everything. I mean, everybody who's talked about him has been pretty effusive in their love for him, and then also very clear, let's make it clear, he was an addict, and that was always evident. Like, it just seems pretty, people are pretty honest about him.
I was fairly scared to death of him.
Uh-huh. I get that.
The first time I saw him was a friend of mine was taking his class, and she said, come along to the class and just look and check it out.
Uh-huh.
It's not going to be a problem. And then when I walk in, he goes, who's this? Who the hell is that? And it was like, oh, thanks a lot. Oh, now I've got this bad, you know. And then the first class I legitimately took from him, I was just, oh, to go on stage the first time was the scariest thing.
Yeah.
I had seen somebody else go on and just bomb like a dying death. And I thought, oh my God, I just got to go up. And I was sitting next to, I don't know if you know Ali Farinakian.
Not personally.
He was sitting next to me, and we were both really nervous. And Ali was drinking out of a paper bag, and we were just like, so nervous. But then
Holy
once you
shit.
started, you know, you were still, I was still like, I tried to ask him some questions during the break, but it's like, how do you ask, what do you do? Like I remember one time just going, have you ever been, did you go to Altamont? And he goes, yeah, I did. I went to Altamont. It was terrible. And you know, like he will engage you in a conversation, but it just seems weird. Like you're going up to this guy and
A guy with whom no one has any shared experiences or can relate to. I don't think he was relatable in terms of, I mean, who was telling me the story where, like, yeah, he came in and he's like, where were you, Del? Oh, I just came from a naked witch party of some kind. He had just been dancing around naked with a bunch of Wiccans somewhere in Chicago, and that was just his life. That was just, he would just show up after so he didn't have a life anybody could relate to. This, 50, 60-year-old dude who had just lived more seemingly than anybody and continued to try to do that. I've heard good stories too, also. Like, just he seemed like a guy who would be supportive if you did what he considered the right stuff. Like, if you were
Yeah,
good.
no, he would back you if you were doing the right thing. And I remember hearing he was trying to quit smoking, so he had this rubber band snap therapy where he would give himself a painful snap with this long elastic rubber band. And so you'd be doing a scene, right? And you'd be going, hey, let's go to the ship and snap. So you'd be like hearing it in the back of your mind, and you would think, what does that mean? It's bad? Is he, no? And it just turned out he's just snapping himself.
Just so he doesn't have the urge to smoke. Holy shit. Wow. To have a guy living his life so out loud while you're trying to do comedy for him is,
I know. He, it was just kind of, I never got to the point where I was like comfortable. I know some guys were.
Sure. But yeah, no, I mean, there's
But
no
yeah.
way I could have handled that. I can tell you that for sure. I would have run. I probably would have cried. I would imagine, knowing who I was in my 20s, if he had been around and I'd met him, yeah, I would have just cried and run away. I'm certain that's how it would have ended.
I remember a guy in our class stupidly asked if he had any weed on him or something. And then he made an announcement in class, like, I don't want anyone asking me for reefer or whatever he said.
Holy shit. He's another who also made like one of these like hard to find, relatively hard to find comedy records back in
How
the
to Speak
60s.
Jazz.
Yeah. Oh wait, shit, there's two of them. 'Cause there's How to Speak Hip and then there's oh God, what's the name of the other one? My brain is fried, but
The
either way, he
committee.
made Oh yeah, I mean I think there is a committee record that he might also be on as well. So he's on a few of them for sure. But did you were you familiar with his work be or just his reputation?
Well, it's what was good was while we were there, he was actually doing stuff. Like he was the I think at Steppenwolf they did the Chicago Seven, and
Oh,
he was
okay.
the judge.
Love it. Okay.
And he had this interesting theory. He goes, I'm playing the judge slower because, oh wait, was it slower or faster? Because he said, as you're older, everything goes like a second added on to your life is but a drop in a bucket. Whereas if you're young, it's a lot faster because it's, I don't know. So anyway, he was talking about that
Yeah.
as he was doing it, and it was interesting because we'd go and watch him, and he did a couple of shows with Dave Pasquazi, I remember. And yeah, and then, you know, I'd start to familiarize with what he had done and stuff.
Yeah, I think the only thing I knew when I was in Chicago for a couple of years, I just knew him from Ferris Bueller. That was what I knew him from first. And then people like, you know, he's like a really big comedy icon. I'm like, oh, I had no idea. So that's where I had to learn about it was I think finding out about him in Ferris Bueller. When let's skip back a bit to the first family, what other records were sitting around the house? What other comedy records did your family have that you might
well,
have listened
like
to?
I said, the Bob Newhart one, I listened to almost as much. And you had already done that one with someone.
Yeah, we, a bunch. Otherwise, I would have been like, yeah, let's talk about it. But yeah, the first family we've only we've talked about in a sideways way once or twice with a few people. But it's this is one we have not over-talked, in my opinion. So
it was the button mount mind, the button down mind strikes back or something. I'm trying to think what other comedy albums were out around then.
Did they have any Smothers Brothers? Any
for
Alan
my parents?
Sherman?
No, my dad was in the Air Force, so I don't think he liked the.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Herb Albert, Frank Sinatra.
Sure.
But and then I would get stuff on the side on my own.
Yeah, that was my next question.
I'd get the George Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
You get the Steve Martin.
And this was stuff you could share with your friends, I think, I assume.
Yeah, my friend had the Cheech and Chong. Did you have a lot of your parents' albums?
Yes. That's why this show is all about comedy on vinyl, because very specifically, my mom gave me a bunch of her records and a bunch of my grandmother's records that she no longer wanted because I guess she had lost her sense of humor. And so she gave me Smothers Brothers, Carlin, not Cheech and Chong. I must have gotten that on my own. But Smothers Brothers and Carlin, Nichols and May, and a few other like seminal ones that it turns out everybody else owned and heard growing up when they were, you know, obviously a bit older than I was. So I grew up with them a generation or two generations later. So yeah. And then I didn't really start buying them until I started this podcast, but yeah, I grew up with a few on vinyl that were kind of critical to who I was, I think.
Nichols and May. Yeah. I mean, and Monty Python I would watch, but I wouldn't, I think it was on PBS where I was. And I think this was on an album, but my parents didn't have it. It was Beyond the Fringe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Derek and Clive. But I think I remember there was some kind of Vanity Fair article or something that attempted to do a family tree of comedy.
Oh, my.
And I think that they traced down the origins of modern day comedy to Beyond the Fringe.
Interesting. It makes sense. I can see that.
Or maybe it was like the Goons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, the Goons. It's so funny because when we talk about this, normally when the Goons never come up with it with, you know, somebody who also has an American accent, it's normally, you know, English people who know who the hell the Goons were. And they still have a presence over there. I'm sure they're even on reruns in radio or something over there, probably, because radio is still a thing in the UK.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
Yeah. See, that's the crazy thing. That makes sense. I mean, especially like with their direct influence on Python, their obvious influence on Python, but then all the things the different guys in the Goons went off to do. Yeah, that makes sense. I can see that. And then Beyond the Fringe for sure was an extension of that. And then Dudley Moore, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, on the one side of me likes studying it and stuff, and another side of me just dispenses with all of that and
You
just,
same. Well, it's like it's one of those things where if you also have to make comedy at some point, you have to disconnect from it. Otherwise, you're going to over-examine your own shit to the point where why bother? At least that's
Well, and
how I feel.
also you're gonna say, "Oh my God, where have I seen that from?
Yep.
Did
Yep.
somebody do that?" And then you start looking on YouTube and stuff. Yeah, you can't do that.
Nope. Nope. Because half the time it's either parallel thought or you realize just because it's the same idea doesn't mean it's the same exact joke. And then again, you dig too far into it. And yeah, no, I've fallen down that rabbit hole many, many, many times. I've cut jokes from albums that I've done where I'm like, I feel like somebody else did this better.
Really?
Yeah,
Yeah, you can't.
or I stole it on accident. That's the big one. If I realize I absolutely stole it and didn't mean to, then that will definitely, then it'll go. But
Well,
I'm.
that's a big fear, isn't it? Like, even after you do it, somebody goes, "Oh, isn't that such and such?"
I did a sketch. I tried to do a pilot for Adult Swim years ago that they did not give a shit about and had a whole lengthy sketch that was okay and it was all right put together. But the idea was fun. They're like, oh, that's an Upright Citizens Brigade sketch, right? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. I didn't see every episode of the Upright Citizens Brigade show.
Right.
So how would I, but that's not where I got it from. But they're like, oh, that's a well, good, great. Well, thank you for that.
Plus, people aren't very constructive. They're more willing to say, "Oh, that reminds me of," rather than, "Oh, that's funny."
Right. Did
You
you laugh?
know?
If not, that's okay. But I don't need to know what it reminds you of. I don't need to
Yeah.
hear who you think I was influenced by.
Because that reflects more on you, like, "Oh, aren't I smart? Because I recognize where that might be from.
Very much so.
It's
That's
from
very much
Johnny Appleseed, the original roving comic."
Oh my God. Have you have you found a I mean obviously you've made so much of your career in the UK and but was there any level of adaptation for you in terms of styles, influences or anything, or did you immediately sort of fall into the scene?
You mean influences like in
Well, in terms of, I know your influences are going to be different from the other guys in the Mighty Boosh, I and other stuff you've worked on. I'm curious if that at all affected your ability to fall in line and learn the British way of doing comedy. Was there ever any kind of a learning curve, or did you fall right into it with them?
I was always kind of all the Monty Python and stuff, I felt like I was already well versed in, and I, it was my sort of default mode to be more in that kind of silliness. So I didn't have too much problem, but I mean, basically, all of the stuff that I was doing, I try to forget. And naturally, they always say this about stand-up, is like a lot of people copy somebody initially
Sure.
and then they make it their own. Well, I think I brought a little bit of my own. And if you happen to subconsciously bring stuff out, then so be it. I mean, that's what happens. But I felt like I didn't have to sort of adjust that much. Like, "I'm an American comic and I
Sure.
have to, what is this guy saying about lorries?"
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always curious because, there are a select few American acts or American comics, American comedians who make the all I'm just saying is I'm very jealous of your career and let's trade
Go
places.
on. Go on. Let's trade now. I'm moving up to yours.
And now you're very sad.
No.
you host a podcast that's about to end. Like this one's fun. Even though I've derailed us by talking about, other stuff that I also want to
That's okay. That's okay.
talk about. I always like to ask people to tell the audience why they should listen to The First Family if they've never heard it.
Because not only is it funny in itself, but it's like a slice of history, because it's like you said, once Kennedy was assassinated, this guy's career went in the toy. I don't know what happened to him, but I mean, and you know, it was such a fleeting time in the U.S. I mean, I think it was just like, you can, there's a lot of love in this album too. It's like
for sure.
A love fest with the president, and you sort of get a feeling for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's comedy, but if you're a student of comedy, you'll also love it for what it represents. And I think that anybody who's interested in the least bit in comedy and presidential history
well,
would
I think
listen to that.
I think the way you pointed out that you know, if all modern comedy can be traced back to the Goons, this is at the very least the success of the comedy album as an industry can be traced back to this record as well. So it's worth thinking about it in those terms. Like, we might not have had a comedy album industry as much as we did in the 60s and 70s and somewhat into the 80s if it wasn't for this thing selling 7.5 million records when nothing had ever sold that much. So, you know, it's also
I mean, the White House was considered kind of sacrosanct.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know if any other I don't think there was an Eisenhower spoof show.
No,
but I think this was kind of like the first president to really be spoofed.
Mm-hmm. Especially for this length and in this manner. They obviously got harsher and harsher with Johnson and Nixon, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it definitely broke that mold.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you can see later on Saturday Night Live, it's just taken it one step further.
For sure. Rich, thank you very, very much for doing the show. I'm glad we got to speak before I ended it. I really appreciate it. I'm a big
fan.
And you're a delight. I normally would say you're welcome back, which you would be. But, you know, here's the thing. If the show comes back in some other form, then you're welcome back. We'll just say that.
We'll leave it at that.
I just want to thank everybody for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn.